The Bushes by China Mieville. Then, standing a long time below knotted roots, he looked down at his feet through water the colour of tea. You could not say he did not know how to stay still. Larval specks probed his skin, the pox of his joints, dark nails. The muck of the island came up between his claws. He was investigated by snail, by tiny sinuosity. A pale leech attached itself, spat off at the taste of him and bunched and unfolded to make its way, and he watched and wondered why such an animal would ever take this over that direction, what occurred to it, and where, if there was a spot of slime within its slime in which it thought leech ideas and made leech decisions, or did it think with tangles of thread-like stuff diffused throughout it, or did it think with its bowels full of blood? If it did not think, was it alive? He said it was. Everything was alive here. He said, yes, aloud. Wondered if it was to the leech that he spoke. It went by urgent peristalsis. With his fingers, he mimicked its motions. Sun through the mangroves, too bright. He rolled his eyes, looked instead into the dark of his own skull, to return to birds' announcements. Approach a bayou right, all you saw in it was reflection, so it glowed as if he crept toward a hole in the jungle floor to a secret sky beneath. He took down his sangar. He walked for 3 days. He leaned upon his spear. He had hardened its point in a beach fire. He probed with the base of it to gauge the swamp's depth. He raised it and waited, become landscape, lunging at a sound to send it into the green where something might scream. With the trees so thick, the largest lizards would not come here, and he listened for the crash of herons or koipu or the caimans. His catches he ate raw. He spoke to the carcasses, took a dagger to them to see how they worked. He took out a notebook and charcoal to make marks, and every time he had to strive against the blankness of a page, he would be still and tell himself that he had already ruined the book, so that was that now, and it being too late to save it, he could continue. He tried to draw what he had killed, their inmost places, the cast of their heads, birds on their boughs, spectating snakes. He wrote, "The constrictor does not blink." Yes, he was sure his observations were worthless. Because of that, the book was trash now, and he could write in it. The catamount follows at a distance. It moves with a great silence in the branches. It does not grip with its tail, as do the small monkeys with theirs. That done, he turned pages back to where the first owner had annotated her own illustrations in inks he did not have. Fine black crosshatch, bright blue and golden plumage. Small nares she had written in her precise hand. Coverts, rich tones, call, mimic ship's whistle. Seeing her images in the earlier days, he had hit and scratched his face sometimes at the ugliness of his own. He wished he sweated, brought brine with him. The itch the heat occasioned had distracted him until he ceased attempting to ignore it and investigated it instead. This is my body. This is how it prickles. Curious about the discomfort, he bore it. I will come to the sea and I will go in, he thought. Until then, this is my bristling. Light, as if through green glass. He tasted smoke and knew where he had come. Moving low, he let his mind get on with its business, of thinking again that he had not declared his destination to himself, so could he be said to have known it? He took paths he had made himself. Lianas reached for him. He pulled himself up into low branches, looked through a cleft to a green incline, above shade, a lone longhouse. The soldier had last come here on a night without a moon, ceaselessly swinging his head, tasting for blood, with the twitchy speed of a hunter, pining for his old motion. Bent double, he had crept as if he swam shallows, and the waving grass was waves, and he had let the crescent of his fin announce him to shoreline spectators he dreamed up. Now he waited in a tree. "What's the most important skill you'll learn?" The voice of his sergeant. "No, no, no, no. No, it's none of them. It's patience. It's doing nothing." Mosquitoes failed to pierce his hide. A fly tried to drink from the corner of his great black eye. When the grass swayed, covered an approach, he knew it was a child coming. He knew which child it would be. On the slope, the grass thinned. A spindly figure in a hide skirt emerged. The watcher did not move. No child would know what it was they looked at if they saw him. They might not know to be afraid. This child lowered itself and skittered, slid down the slope. At the bottom, it sat a while, then stood and took the shadowed path, and the watcher tasted seeds dislodged by the descent. The longhouse was raised at each corner on a tree trunk stilt. All that remained of its stain were desquamating patches. What interwoven leaves had adorned its roof were rotted, and fungus mottled the planks. The building listed on a straining strut. The child passed into the underside, stooped, picked something up, held it close to its eye. The watcher had found pottery bits there and offcuts of turtle shell. The child was slim and small. The green of its skin was pale as a plant struggling in a dark place, and the crossbars of paint across its face were not done well. It sat and with its finger drew a circle and scooped up debris and threw it down within, and the watcher remembered a witch reading spillikins, but the child snatched up what it had thrown too quickly to play at telling fortunes if that was its intent. "Now, now," the watcher mouthed without sound. "Now come on. I knew you'd come here. Come on now, eh?" In his head he called this child Sum for lonesome. An image came to him of the ruined tree releasing the hut it held at last for it to fall upon the playing child. The watcher had to roll away his sight and hold his breath a while. When he looked again, he gauged the thickness of the pillars and whether he could cut them to bring the building down when the child was gone so he would not have to worry anymore. The first two times he had spied on the township, it was crouched down with a burly comrade who hated this duty and would only ever speak to describe that part of the foreign sea from which he came. When he did, his face grew wide with loss. Beyond the council hut and the thrashing trench, and minutes east of the conclave and stockade, they had found the conversation grounds. There were no trees, but the clearing was full of low, round, berryless bushes with glossy leaves, each 2 or 3 yards from its nearest neighbours. Into the matter of four such were stitched bones, the shed hides of snakes, blown eggs. Obsidian beads and painted shells dangled by sinews interlaced in geometries. These were the avatars of the forebearers to whom the place was consecrated. See them from such and such an angle, you might persuade yourself these constellations limned abstract figures. Locals came seemingly at no schedule to talk to the psychopomps. They would greet all four godlings according to a courteous paradox. Hello, goodbye, hello, then speak the name of whichever tricksy guide was interlocutor. The watcher had translated these honorifics into the not writing of his own language, and now watching the child, he fingered the cords at his belt to read them. Old careful man, ash lizard, shadow sister, the hole. Children came too to the grounds and played games around the ancestors, except for ash lizard, from which they kept a distance and which watched them with its rotting fruit eyes. It was here that the watcher had first seen some trailing the other children into the clearing to where they mummed battles and domesticity. And though he knew their language, their high-voiced, rapid argot made the details of their pleasures and disputes, their truce terms and intimacies, obscure. He had made up his own names for them, his own stories of what he witnessed. So vivid was the broad, quick-moving boy who hated Sum in this script, and tall was the sister or brother of Darkface who pretended to follow Vivid but secretly was of Sum's party, and so on. Recalling these stories, the watcher scolded himself for doing other than watching closely. Sum might follow behind the others without words, chin down. Once, when there were 10 children, the Watcher had seen Vivid separate them into 3 groups for some game. 3 and 3 and 3, and he had left some unchosen. Before he joined his own partners in the gathering, Vivid paused. Some had stood, as if they might still be picked, with a voice carefully still, and Vivid did not look at some, and his restraint in the triumph of his spite was adult enough to shock the Watcher. When the others left, some had stayed behind a while, then headed to this broken hut, approaching which and its sunken path now were Vivid and Darkface, and those the soldier called Downlooker and Spinner and others. Some could hear them coming and was still. The woman was not a soldier, but she had led the rambling investigation of the Hot Islands. She had seen the Watcher look at her notebook. She'd said, "Can you write?" "Properly," he'd said, "with string." She had showed him lines for cords, ink blots where you'd tie knots. "What's that?" he asked her of animals and plants. "What's that?" she would tell him. His comrades did not mock him, but they watched without warmth or sympathy. He would not join in their complaints, would not say to her, "Why are we even here?" But as if he had, standing looking up into rain in a late dark afternoon, she had said to him, "We're here to list everything." "You can't list everything." "No, you can't list but a tiny part of everything, but it's a start, and you can't but start. What else can you do? Nothing is more important than itemizing." Now he watched the children. The newcomers stood beyond the hut and stared at some beneath it, who stood now, held out a hand flat-palmed as if to share the debris thereupon. Vivid made a peremptory gesture and said nothing and moved away, and his companions followed him on the path past the shadow, some with glances backwards, some not at ease, and some stood alone. "Look at the child there left behind, little body in that obscurity, closing and lowering a hand, and if they let fall what they had held to scatter again in final unpassed prophecy, the Watcher could not see it." He thought, "I can go and speak to them." He thought, "I could be a voice from the trees. Call me the stinker in the sun. Call me tooth shedder. I am Ash Lizard's friend. I'm here because I hear what you whispered in the conversation grounds." He had awakened, weeks back, alone, on this island's farthest shore, picked up the notebook that was left as if for him, had stalked a long way, seeking his companion's trail, biting the air as if to squeeze out its blood and tasting nothing but the sap of all the green fuses through which he roamed. Now he went past a hidden sinkhole and a serpent's nest, came close to the hut, to the motionless child, to whom he extended silent fellowship, moving his mouth as if in those greetings he had auditioned, as if he would play that spirit part for the child, but going on, moving on past. He followed the other children and heard their voices. "Here? By the dark leaves?" "I said the dark." The melismatic sounds that meant equivocation. The Watcher passed them, hidden in the growth. An ancient tree had fallen, and he waited in its root overhang. They rounded the trail and could not see him, and his anger astonished him. They went by where he watched them, and one looked back. He could not know with what emotion, whether with regret. It was not Vivid. He raised his spear and looked at the hesitating child, as curious as if it were a new beast, and then at Vivid, at the head of the explorers. He sighted, felt how the spear would move, tough barracuda, swimming through the air, its oscillations, the spin of it, its impact. He let the weapon fall. Tangled plants caught it. He shook. The children walked on. The soldier bent and found a stone. He picked it up, and as he stood again, it came to him that it was only sentiment to think that to itemize meant anything, that lists were power, or names were, or words were. That made him gasp, and did Vivid turn his head at the sound? If he did, he saw nothing. The Watcher threw nothing. You don't know what will return you to which memory. A percussion of wood as trees lashed each other in a quick, hot, violent storm. There was to his recollection of the swaddling up-close press and pressure he had left behind a quality of the hermetic. Why would any dryland danger wrench him back so to the foothill columns of black smokers, their unique scalding life, him braced against what should never rise to his city's deeps, or a bob above carnage, trying to re-see what he had seen so his friend might not have died. It might be the most placid topside night that pulled him back. It might be stillness itself. Can you hear me? Are you listening? I raised my hand to volunteer for this business and thought I did it for prestige. No, I did it to be somewhere so strange as this. Inside himself, he said, "You will always be there." He said, "And you will always be within the streets before that. Here upon the island, pushing fronds that moved with that angularity so unlike how kelp swayed, he was also there in the worst of the war. And he was also in the coral slums, a nameless pup again, and he was hungry." "Hey," he said. Nothing would reply to him. He listened to the villagers' voices and the hiss and fuss of their puff-chested little reptile flocks. The bats whispered and he came to the conversation place. Only stars and fireflies shone and everything was only outlines. "Hello," he said. "Goodbye, hello." He stood amid the clots of growth and said it again to each ancestor plant in turn. You would have to strain to hear him. Old careful man's gaping mouth was a wooden bowl. At the core of the hole was a vortex of dried umbilica. One by damp one, he shook the bones of ash lizard. It was not the hole, but the branches of Shadow Sister of which he took hold. He hugged her close, never mind the thorns. "I don't know," he whispered. Looking in again at the darkness of his own within, he pressed his face deep into the spirit's bramble body. "Hello and goodbye and hello, sister." His bashial was heavy in his mouth. He spoke into the void at the heart of the plant and felt the touch of insect feet and the vibrations of the stains and trinkets that comprise the body into which he would tell secrets. "Are you there and can you hear me? Is there a you to be there? Hello, goodbye, hello, I don't know how you like to receive visitors. Once someone told me, a friend, she told me my great-great-back-a-bit grandparents had their own hunt gods chewed out of rock, and she said you'd bring them things to eat and lay them down. That was polite. I don't know if you like offerings. I never saw anyone bring you anything. You know what I think? I think words are the offering. Maybe you can't hear me, you're not my ancestor. Is that true? If it's true, do you care? Ah, but what do you have else to do but listen, Shadow Sister? I'd bring you honey or meat or anything you want if it would make a difference. Here." It did not take so much to pull a tooth from his gums. He dropped it into the darkness as if it was a seed and would grow. "There," he said. "So here's what I have to say." He wanted to speak of his dead friend, and of all the dead, but he probed the vegetable darkness with his mouth and could not. "These villager children," is what he said when he spoke again. "One reminds me of me. All of them do, but one more than the others. The way children are with each other, I don't know. You can't like everything you see, but then can you change it? Don't tell anyone, but I'm absent and I have no leave to be. We were here guarding a woman doing investigations. Then I was here alone and everyone was gone but me. I did what I was supposed to do. I took the book for her. Does it scare you when a child does what it does, the way it does it with every bit of its whole self? Everything's all up too close, every one of their feelings. A child on its own makes you more lonely than being alone yourself ever did. See one be cruel to another and it makes you feel the worst shame. Hey, do you even understand?" He was speaking his own tongue. Well, there are ghosts around me and they're dead and you're dead, so they'll translate for you because you all must speak the same language there where you are. I woke up and the other soldiers were gone and the boss was gone, and when I'd not found them, it was on me to go back to barracks, and it's a way, but I was crossing the country. He had taken out the book. In meadowlands between paludal thickets, turned the pages not yet written on by anyone but the woman. There are 1,000 animals in this place that would kill you, he said. They left me be, though. When I came up the first time, well, he said, I don't know how to say how it was. He knew the uncanniness of dry land motion would not ever cease to arrest him, nor did he wish it. No more of the elision of his own youth, the billowing of moments and things one into another. Here, movements abrupt as saccade, each touch and scuffle and animal scud, the back forth your pitch bounce of windblown plant life drew the edges of all entities and of time's atoms. There was a bird, he said. I saw it see me, and I looked in the book and saw she'd drawn a picture of one like it, and the picture was as good, as particular, as the one watching, but there were no words on the page. I never want to stop being a visitor, he said into Shadow Sister. That was the first thing I wrote, what I could think of to say about that blue bird. Of course, I've considered that to be left alone like that must have been part of the mission. Enemies and animals would have taken me too. So yes, perhaps it is a test. The abandonment and instruction it's my duty to decode then follow. Maybe I'm not rogue at all. Maybe I'm not disobeying orders. Maybe I'm obeying. I hope not, he said into the spirit bush at last. I hope I'm a deserter. Even to Shadow Sister, he did not disclose that on the book's last page was a line of symbols, a cipher he could not read. Why should I still be around, he said. After everything, I mean. How's that right? I'm going to fill this book with animals. What I want is to give something to the child, he said slowly into the must. I want to give something to the one who puts me in mind of me. Would you help me? I could do something for it. I'd like to. He straightened and breathed night air and heard the whine of something as curious at his faint motion as he was of its. Yes, he addressed the spirit. Yes, that is a possibility. By dawn he was miles north. The land was a steepening funnel, and the air was full of dust. He found a hide in splintered cast and put his palm flat on the stone. He watched buzzards. Noon. The rock shook. He raised his head. He marked his heartbeats. From the ravine came a great shape, the curve of a heavy head, a split in it, big mouth with spit ropes unrolling, and the teeth, that tongue, lightless little eyes that saw him, so he hissed and stood and sighted down his spear's trembling haft. The thing crouched and reached with its upper limbs and began to run, and the dirt leapt with its coming. He watched. It came. He had looked up at towers once and down at war. Make a list of those who'd died in his regard. Of what worms and ground crawlers and dragonflies would see him die now if he were to die. The beast came. He lowered his weapon. He opened his empty balancing hand and looked at his wide fingers, and like the ground they shook. Oh, thought the watcher with distant interest, I am afraid. He had to brace not to stumble in the tremors of the footsteps. He watched everything, watched the late light upon the claws of what approached him. Until his muttering day, the boy's name had been Shud. Now it is Duri or Ko, and it would be until his darkening. He asks if he might go to the river. Uncle shields his eyes, says first he must complete 3 tasks that he has the boy chant. Duri says Mora should do them, but Uncle trills to warn him against dispute, and he lowers his eyes and takes the grubs and, singing the feeding song, goes to the pond and scatters handfuls for the fish. He returns and takes the broom and sweeps the path and takes care to draw the spirals in the dirt. Uncle makes him make obeisance to the altars in the eaves. Duri goes to the conversation place. He stops because Shadow Sister is splayed and many of her pieces have fallen. No one comes. Duri is afraid, walking the path back from the idols to the township, and he holds his hands up in the pose of a wrestler, as the guards showed him, and if a hungry ghost is watching, it will say, "No, not that boy. See how the boy walks, what a warrior." He finds his friends. They are forbidden to, but they go to the rear of the night soil shack to whisper and to laugh at the sounds and smells emanating from within. As it always does at this game, there comes to Duri the image of himself watched by the others, holding quiet Noom by the shoulders and pushing him inside the cabin and dangling him over the midden and letting him fall and gasping as he lets go to show that his intent had only been to scare but that he had lost his grip, gasping loud enough that Noom and everyone would hear it before the impact in the shit, so when Duri was punished it would be for a mistake rather than for cruelty and he would accept it, would kneel on sand, would take Noom's sanctioned slaps, singing the I'm Sorry song for many hours, and thinking all that, Duri shivers in the shaded fringe as the other children giggle, because he knows he will deserve a greater punishment, or half deserve it, because it is true it will not exactly be his plan to let Noom fall, but if he ever carries out this game, which he will not, but he could, and if he did, he knows that he will lose his grip, though he promises the universe and himself that he will not, and he is excited and confused by that contradiction, and anyway, he tells the listening world, this is only a thought game which does not ease his shortness of breath at the what if. Let's go to the broken hut, Duri says. He regrets it even before he sees the others' faces. It is too soon since the last time, and Boemi and Shem are uneasy, though he does not say Noom's name. They race water runners, and Duri draws his nail along the inside of his own arm, looking back into the jungle. The patterns of the hut's path are effaced by the day's traffic. Standing on the threshold, he sees Noom at last, in the shade by the armory. Noom is looking at him. Duri is glad that all he has to stare into in turn are two darker shadows in a shadow face. He enters and sits upon his bed, and there is something hard beneath the thin blanket. The other children are at their day's end activities, and he does not move a while. The uncle is cleaning the hearth. Duri goes and says to him politely, "Did Noom come in?" No one came in. Duri knows there are loose slats at the hut's rear. Beneath the covers is a pouch. It is heavy. He raises his knees to hide what he is doing and unlaces it and draws out a dull green scale. His mouth opens because it fills his palm. A hole has been drilled through it and inches of sinew tied thereto and knotted several times irregularly. He holds his breath. He has been allowed to feel the sharpened scales protruding from the guard's machanas, but the size of this. He dreams into his head the great monarch animal from which this came. He grips the scale hard enough that he hopes he bleeds. Duri turns it and learns that he is not surprised to see script scratched upon the underside, as if secrets had been directed in toward the animal's bones. He sees rounded letters akin to those on the scrolls merchants bring, and he sees three scored lines, sequences of dots. The first time he tries to copy the marks on bark, it falls apart under his hands. When he succeeds, he seeks Agim, who is old and watches the garden and throws stones with his one remaining hand to keep animals away. "Hey," Duri says, "you can read." He lays the sheet flat. His heart is shaking him because what if the message accuses him of transgressions of which he's guilty? Agim looks at Duri and at the cuts. "Well," he says, he points at the top. "This is trade talk. Where did you find this? Will you say it for me?" Agim runs his finger along it and he grunts and makes dog noises and then laughs. "Please, Agim, will you tell me what it means then?" The old man looks at him with an intrigued and shrewd compassion. Agim says, "It means, here, tough child, armor for you, rescue yourself, the spirit says, hush, I will listen, hush, I will hear." "Where are your friends, boy?" he says. "I always see you with your friends." "What about these?" Duri points at the other clotted lines. Agim is silent a long while. "If this is anything, I don't know what," he says. "I don't know this language, if it's language. This is for you to find out yourself. Where are your friends? That's your task now, isn't it, to read this other part of this message?" "Most days I see you with your friends," Agim says. "All of you talking and not talking. Following. Hey? Duri?" Duri does not look at him but into the forest, and he does not look away from it when the old man takes hold of him and says his name again. The boy is too caught up in terror and in a certainty that he's watched from a dark place. And with a wash of other feeling too, a new feeling, new to him. "What if I am seen?" Duri thinks. He thinks it with fear, then thinks it once more with relief.